You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme.
Tonight we've reached a milestone in our nation's march toward a more perfect union. The first time that a major party has nominated a woman for president.
We'll be analysing a big week in US politics. My guests, Andrew Tuck and Matt Alagai, will be discussing this and today's other top stories, including the top job at the UN, why a current Australian Prime Minister has just denied a former one from becoming UN Secretary General. We'll also be looking at Europe and asking which cities might be set to pull ahead against the continent's major players amid a climate of both economic and political uncertainty. All that plus, what makes a good art collection an art collector? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today, as ever on a Friday, all from the Monocle editorial floor, our editor Andrew Tuck and our business editor Matt Alagaya. And before we get into the first story, Andrew, we have just put to bed the September issue.
Put to bed is probably kind of pushing your luck, Steve. It's kind of like a kind of badly behaved child that's slightly under the duvet but kicking like crazy, and maybe a bit of a push before it goes to sleep, I think.
Okay.
But tomorrow, we get the joyful task of coming in here on a Saturday when doing a big issue, and we will, you won't because you're off on holiday, but I will definitely be kind of coming in here. There's one nice thing about coming in on a Saturday. We order food from D1, the takeaway around the corner. We have a Lebanese lunch on a Saturday.
It is actually one of the nice things about coming in on Saturday.
It's when a falafel lures people in.
It does indeed. We're going to talk a bit more about what's in that September issue a little bit later, because it chimes in with one of our stories. But we're going to begin by taking a look back at what happened last night in Philadelphia. Indeed, the whole week, really, in the US, because it has been another big week in American politics. And amid the usual fireworks of the nation's election year circus, the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia has produced a genuine landmark this week. We knew it was coming, but it's still important nonetheless. Hillary Clinton has become the first ever female candidate leading a major political party in the race for the White House. She accepted her nomination to lead the party last night, but among the big speeches on stage in Philadelphia, the words of Khizr Khan, a Muslim father whose son was a US soldier killed during the Iraq War, also made the headlines. Let's hear a little bit from both speeches there from Mr. Khan and Ms. Clinton.
As patriotic American Muslims with undivided loyalty to our country, like many immigrants, we came to this country empty-handed. We believed in American democracy, that with hard work and goodness of this country, we could share in and contribute to its blessings.
Standing here as my mother's daughter and my daughter's mother, I'm so happy this day has come. I'm happy for grandmothers and little girls and everyone in between. I'm happy for boys and men, because when any barrier falls in America, it clears the way for everyone.
Hillary Clinton then, before we heard from Khizr Khan. Matt Alagaya, I want to talk about Khizr Khan's speech first, because as we heard there was also an even more dramatic theatrical moment a little bit later in that speech, where he criticised Donald Trump, who's obviously made a big pledge during this election to ban all Muslims from America, where he said, you know, my son wouldn't have been able to fight during the war in Iraq if it had been for Donald Trump. And he whips out a copy of the US Constitution and says, have you read the US Constitution? And the crowd go nuts. It was quite a moment, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I think, you know, that was actually the most damning speech that could possibly have happened here for Donald Trump. You know, everyone who spoke this week at the Democratic Convention was talking about, you know, quoting bits back at him and saying, you know, this is crazy. You know, he's a bit of a madman. But actually, that speech, it was just absolutely perfect. We had this father of a clearly incredibly patriotic man, Muslim man who was American and had fought for America and posthumously won a medal for his bravery. And it was just the perfect way of saying, showing kind of how completely vacuous all of Donald Trump's policies and all of his kind of the things that he's been saying about banning Muslims, as you said, all of that was.
And Andrew Tuck, the speech from Hillary Clinton, you know, I know we know this is, you know, we knew for a year this was going to happen, that Hillary Clinton was probably going to be the nominee, that it would be historic, that it would be the first female candidate to be the candidate from a major party. And yet there was something still about seeing her accepting that nomination and making the point that this is a huge milestone for the US that was actually quite moving for many Americans watching.
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, this speech has been rehearsed for weeks and weeks and weeks. Probably the first draft may have been done months and months and months ago. But still, she had to deliver. You know, she had to do a speech like no other speech, because we know that Donald Trump, you know, left the Republican convention on a high. He barnstorms his speeches. He, you know, rabble rouses the crowd. Could she do the same with the Democratic convention? And could she pull in the Bernie Sanders supporters who had been heckling her at the start of the week? Now, it's a tough ask for any politician to do that. And oddly, I think it's a tougher ask for a woman politician to do that. And here's why, if you bear with me one for a second. I think it's interesting that we ask of female politicians two complicated things. We ask them to kind of man up, as it were, to be tough, you know, hard edge, brutal, don't cry, you know, don't show your emotional side, you know, come across just like any other guy who's a politician. We push them into a kind of a male kind of cutout, whatever. But on the other side, when it comes to it, we also want them to be a bit fluffy. And we also want them to reveal their human side and to have some kind of emotional connection with motherhood, with, you know, with their families and things, which we wouldn't ask of a male politician. So they have to do two very, very complicated things. Now, what Hillary Clinton has done for two decades is she stood behind two extraordinary men. Bill Clinton, who she supported through thick and rather a lot of thin, and then Barack Obama, who will go down, apart from the kind of the Trumpists, as one of the greatest speechmakers that there is. You know, he is extraordinary. So now she comes on. You know, she's, you know, the Rolling Stones have all left the stage. Now she's on. What's she going to do? And she has to pull off these two very complicated things. And watching the speech, I think what was more touching than actually almost the message was that she did it. That she stood there and she connected with people. And, that, you know, I watched some of the coverage. And what was amazing when you saw the cameras scan that crowd, and it's a damn huge crowd, parts of which were against her in really brutal ways at the beginning of the week. Some of it has melted a little bit by the end of the week. Her outreach to Bernie Sanders, her outreach to his supporters, her move slightly...
And you could see them grudgingly clapping
as
well.
Her move slightly to the left. I just thought, you know, I just thought a skilled delivery. And she did what the crowd wanted, you know, whether it was the warm-up act of Chelsea Clinton, she showed herself, you know, is she an enigma? Probably. But did she show some of the inner workings of her mind? Maybe. And I think enough to kind of pull in the crowd.
Matt, if you're looking at, if you're judging a convention in a traditional way, then this one had everything. You had, you know, yes, that big speech by the candidate at the very end. But in the run-up, you had a knockout speech from Michelle Obama. You had Bill Clinton's great speech. You had Barack Obama last night as well. And think of all the people that didn't even get mentioned that much. Michael Bloomberg made a speech saying, look, I've been a Republican, I've been a Democrat, I've been an independent, you know, I'm supporting Hillary Clinton. You had Tim Kaine, you had Joe Biden, all these names. You look at the Republican convention, they didn't have their former candidate, Mitt Romney, because he refused to go. They didn't have the guy before that, John McCain, because he refused to go. They didn't have George W. Bush, because he refused to go. They didn't have George H.W. Bush, because he refused to go. They had Rudy Giuliani and some weird soap opera people. And it was, you know, if you were to judge these things by how they're done traditionally, Clinton wins by a mile. Can we judge things traditionally, though, this year?
Well, exactly. I mean, so many things have changed this year, and this campaign has kind of thrown so many things out of the water that we wouldn't have expected. But, I mean, you mentioned all the people who weren't there. Who was there as well was Ted Cruz, and he basically said, you know, don't vote for this guy. He stood up at the Republican National Convention and said...
In prime time.
Yeah, and said, you know, vote for anyone up and down the ticket who votes with your conscience, basically, is what he said. So, yeah, no, I mean, it was a strange affair, the Republican Convention. And as you say, the Democratic one has been an absolute knockout. All of those speeches, as you said, were amazing. A lot of praise for Michelle Obama, which was a terrific speech. And, I mean, I think Bill Clinton's speech, we should actually dwell on that for a little moment, because actually there were a lot of questions before this campaign about whether Bill Clinton was going to be a help or a hindrance to Hillary's campaign. And I think he showed himself that he's definitely helped, because I think, you know, he brought out a bit of the kind of human side to Hillary. I know you say, Andrew, that that's a tough thing for her to do. But I think she does come across quite cold a lot of the time. And I think he kind of helped to bring out a much more kind of warm and human side to her.
It did. It's interesting, you know, that we've just had this kind of election of a new British Prime Minister, Theresa May. And she kind of made the same speech in a kind of more modest way. You know, she said, you know, look, I'm not very knowable. I realise, you know, that I don't come across well as a public persona. But you know, I'm good at the job. And in a way, that is the Clinton pitch as well. And I think that is, you know, has always been the pitch. It's, you know, it was the Thatcher pitch. All these people, you know, they just felt that their personal life, they had to be quite tough about, you know, keeping it in the private, because otherwise they wouldn't get ahead in this very male world of politics. And so I think that all of those people were just coming back. There's two things. One, I think it's interesting about, yes, you're right about Trump didn't have many other kind of, you know, follow-up acts. But in a way, people go to see this kind of brute of a man. I don't think anyone... His support, I don't think they care. They don't care if anyone else is there. And the other thing is, we should dwell on the fact that, you know, she was quite good at dismantling Trump on Thursday.
Absolutely.
You know, there's a line, and I don't know why it sticks in my mind, but every time I watch the speech, the line that sticks out is, a man you can bait with a tweet. And there's something, it's almost poetic, but it kind of gets to him. This is, you know, because even during the speech, he was firing off tweet after tweet after tweet. Mm-hmm. He is somebody you can provoke in a second. And she, you know, and also the description of him as a little man, and, you know, that she really, you know, she went after him, and I think that was good as well.
Yeah, and that, and particularly sort of saying a man you can bait with a tweet is not a man that you can trust with nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Is it comes to the heart then of what this election might be about, which is, you know, security and character and leadership. Matt, from a strange entertainment point of view, are you looking forward to the debates?
I think this whole campaign is going to be incredibly brutal. I would love to say that I'm looking forward to it. I think everyone is looking at it with a bit of kind of morbid fascination, because I think it is going to be brutal. We've seen already that Trump is willing to do all kinds of things to unsettle the Hillary campaign. And I'm sure that Hillary's campaign will also be very brutal with Trump. I think, yeah, as you say, from a kind of entertainment standpoint, it might be quite interesting. But so much is at stake, it's difficult to see it in that light, I guess.
I was going to ask you, Steve, it's interesting, the connections with the Brexit campaign. So first of all, you know, Hillary saying, you know, he's running a fear campaign, which we think didn't work here in the UK. That was the Remainers. The Better Together kind of notion is being brought up again. What do you think of the key messages? You know, because they look good on paper, but do you think they connect a deeper way? Because we know that some of these things don't work. You know, for example, I also thought it was interesting when she finally acknowledged, you know, look, you know, we are a great nation, but I understand that some of you are suffering. And I wondered if almost that had come out of that Brexit campaign. You know, you want to say, yes, things are great, the economy is good, you know, we're charging ahead. But if you don't acknowledge that some people aren't able to get on the bus, as it were, then it doesn't work.
I think there are two parallels with the Brexit campaign, one of which I agree with, one of which I'm unsure about. The one that I agree with, which Hillary Clinton supporters should be fearful of, is the fact that the Leave campaign here in the UK really struck a nerve with people who felt they were left behind. And crucially, in terms of the polls, people who don't traditionally vote. So the turnout for the election, for the referendum was 72% here. It was 65% for the election just a year ago. And analysis that's been done of this extra 2.8 million votes, the vast majority of those went to the Leave camp. Normally, if there's a, you know, the turnout's a bit higher, it would be distributed evenly. This wasn't. So they really connected with people who felt left behind. So my concern when you look at the Clinton-Trump campaign election is, are we, when we look at it and go, well, he's not going to win African-American votes, he's not going to win Hispanic votes, he's not going to win female votes. If he wins more angry white men, if there are another 10 million that wouldn't normally vote but now will, then that's going to be really dangerous for her. So that's one issue. The other thing is, does Hillary's campaign look a little bit like the Remain campaign, the sort of the sensible campaign, the you should be scared of these things on the other side, but I'm the sensible one? Here, I don't think it's the parallels, I hope, aren't too similar. I think that Hillary Clinton has enough of a positive argument. And let's not forget that David Cameron tried, who was leading the Remain campaign, changed his mind essentially 3 months beforehand. He had made Eurosceptic speeches pretty much every time he talked about Europe up until 3 months before the vote. It was a harder sell. Hillary Clinton has been saying these things for 20 odd years. So that's my hope. But
we'll see.
Just before we move on, Andrew, one final thing about the political theatre. I mean, do you like it? Do you think actually, you know, it's easy to mock in like the balloons and the set piece speeches and the cheering and the standing ovations and so on? But do you think actually it adds something to it? Do you think it helps connect politics to people?
Very good question. I think, yes, it probably does, as you say, it's going to motivate in this election a group of people who probably have in the past felt politics wasn't for them and have allowed it to sail past them. But I think we see a risk, just as we saw here in the recent referendum in the UK, is I don't know how many facts get out. I don't know how many truths get told. I think that people are being whipped up on both sides, actually, into a state of belief that, you know, everything is one way or the other. And, you know, in America, you've always had this kind of odd thing of consensus politics where, you know, people cross the house and vote on for, you know, to support other people in the other parties. And at the moment, you just get a feeling of America being ripped apart and that consensus disappearing. So, yeah, in the end, I don't think it's for me.
Okay. But the balloons, though. Come on, the balloons.
And I do like the way that they, when they, you know, the together, better together, those nice signs, that they're designed to be kind of not big and square and block out the person behind you. They're very thin and tall.
Yeah.
There's kind of a good kind of like democratic thing about the democratic sign that you don't get blocked out if you're standing in the stadium. I thought that was a nice little way of doing it.
But I guess we should also mention that these conventions aren't necessarily for the rest of the country or even for the rest of the world. I mean, definitely not. They are for the kind of grassroots, and they're there.
But they're for TV. This is, I mean, the thing that's sort of amazing about them is that, you know, there is the entire night is on cable TV, cable news, but 1 hour of each night for 4 days is on every network. They have to show it. So it depends on where you are in the US, 9 to 10 or 10 to 11. But it will, you know, that's on TV.
That's
so it's a
kind
watching. Of made for TV thing.
But we don't know whether it plays out until we see any of the polls.
Yeah.
And that you're right there. I think, you know, that sometimes you can be too excited about what you're seeing in that convention, people cheering, and then, you know, does it hit the mark outside that building? You don't know.
Okay, let's move on. We're going to be joined by Robert Bound, our culture editor, shortly for our final item. But before that, let's turn to events here in Europe. And as Europe has suffered a spate of horrific terrorist attacks over the past few weeks, nobody could blame those with ambitions to find the best cities that the continent has to offer, perhaps approaching the task with a little more trepidation than usual. Add to that some increasing wobbles in the post-Brexit economy, and it's easy to fall into a narrative of doom and gloom when predicting the course of Europe's future. But here at Monocle, we've always looked for the optimistic story amid turbulent times. So today, I want to discuss some of the cities in Europe that are perhaps deserving of a little more of your time. Matt, as we just mentioned, we're focusing a bit on this in the September issue. And we've been talking about it as a company sort of throughout the day as well. From a business perspective, I mean, where are the places where you think are worth keeping an eye on in the coming weeks, months and years?
Absolutely. I think there are obviously certain places that stand to benefit from Brexit. So potentially the flight of businesses out of London. But there are also, I think, when it comes to tourism, it's really interesting for The Escapist, which is on newsstands now. I went to Palermo and I met the mayor there, and he said it's been the best year for tourism there for years and years, for decades.
And no one would have Palermo down as sort of, you know, the new hotspot to go to.
Absolutely, yeah. But it turns out, I mean, you know, it's a sad thing as well, because the people who are missing out on that tourism are Egypt, Tunisia and Turkey. And obviously resorts in those countries are suffering a lot. But the places that are going to, you know, benefit from that are Palermo and Spain. Spain is having a fantastic year for tourism simply because people, you know, they look at those other countries on the Mediterranean. They think, actually, let's go to somewhere in Western Europe that we know will have, you know, better security potentially and still have the sunshine. So a lot of those resorts in Spain and Italy are doing very well.
And Andrew, it's interesting, you know, whenever there are losers, there are winners. And when we've been talking to people for this issue, whether it's, you know, the mayor of Paris or city leadership in Oslo or in Tel Aviv or even in Berlin, there are city leaders that have a positive story to tell and an upbeat story to tell and want to attract newcomers.
Okay, so I'm going to be, you know, as the most miserable, you know, anti-Brexiteer there's been in this building, I'm going to put a slight kind of marker in the sand. I think we do have to be careful about London, that it's not over. Mm. You know, London has got lots to offer. You know, I was just writing something this afternoon which was about the number of new museum extensions, the number of new cultural elements planned for the city over the coming years. And you realise, you know, my God, no other city is going to be able to compete with this. So in that sense, I think that will glue many of the people into the city. I think we're coming out a bit of a funk here, and I think that people will get angrier and more determined, and then there's going to be some bad moments here. But
it's also interesting, you know, we've been talking about, okay, as a sort of jokey thing, could London become a city state? But, you know, if London does have greater autonomy, you know, there are things it could do, and it can still attract people from around the world, can't it?
Yeah, and I think, you know, as someone who is willing to give goodwill to Sadiq Khan, our new mayor, I still kind of feel he's just like oddly absent from the conversation. It's like he should be much more present, saying what, you know, much more protective of what the culture is in the city and explaining why, you know, globalization is also your neighbor, is also the person who serves you food, also lots of things that make our lives rich and enjoyable. So I think there's that. But I think when you look around us, I think the Portuguese will do well out of this. You know, a good, safe city, Lisbon, well integrated. I think even of all the problems in the last couple of weeks, the Germans will do well. You know, I would bet on Berlin gaining a lot of business. And that's the funny thing is when we've been doing the survey for next month, it's going to be an amazing issue, really robust, really positive, really encouraging you to go out there. How many cities are saying, let's ease the migration controls. Let's come up with a special visa just for our city so that people can come and work here. Just at the point where London's saying, oh, I don't know. You know, and well, London's not saying, but central government is. So, but I think that's why in the end it won't stick, because, you know, we want those people, we need them, and we want them to stay here.
It's interesting, Matt, the mayor of Berlin, Hel Müller, who we've interviewed before in Monocle magazine, launched a campaign, I think earlier today, saying, which was a picture of him coming up an escalator as a woman in a headscarf was going down. And the slogan was, "Berlin, let's keep Berlin multicultural."
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty amazing message. I mean, I think Berlin is one of those countries, one of those cities that, you know, London has always been the European startup capital. And I think Berlin is one of those cities that was always kind of vying to beat London in a way. And, you know, they will definitely in Berlin be seeing this as an opportunity for Berlin to take some of that business and some of that, you know, venture capital and all of that from London. And I think, as Andrew said, I mean, you know, our next issue is going to be a bit of a call to action. And I think we need a bit of a call to action in this city as well to say, actually, you know, maybe we need to fight for these businesses and these people.
Can I just say on that? You know, I've never got that hijab debate because, you know, My mum would never have gone out of the house in winter if it was a bit blustery without a headscarf on. She loved a headscarf. No one ever refused to serve her in a restaurant or got cross with her or threw anything at her. You know, when you go to Italy, you would never go in a church without putting a headscarf on. You know, it's, many people feel it's just a modest sign of respect. It's quite a European thing. I don't know why people get so kind of het up about a kind of small square of cloth.
Quite. There we are. We've been joined by Robert Bound. Hello, Robert.
Talking of small squares of cloth, here he is. So am I right? I've come on to talk about ZZ Top.
That's not quite. Okay. Tell you what, why don't I just read this bit,
yeah,
and then everyone will know what we're going to talk about, perhaps even you. We're going to end today's show by looking at collecting and indeed collections and why the art world is assessing both this weekend. The Keeper is a new exhibition in New York's New Museum, and it's a spread of smaller collections themselves. These range from both grand halls and also value light, in the conventional sense, curios, such as French intellectual Roger Callot's collection of rare stones or Swedish artist Hilma Klint's suite of abstract paintings. Rob Bound is here to tell us now about what makes a good collector and what makes a museum-worthy collection. You've got about 3 minutes. Everyone else will jump in.
Yeah, exactly. In record time.
A good collector.
First of all, this is an amazing... This looks like it's an amazing show. Of course, I haven't managed to wing my way to the New Museum on the Bowery in New York City to come and see this one, but it looks amazing. I love the way it's been set out. It looks even crazier than the summer exhibition at the Royal Academy. It's what you call a salon hang. Everything is crazily hung next to each other. It's crammed in. It looks like the work of a mad genius, and I think that's what it's celebrating. It's celebrating, rather than the super collector of modern times, which you might say, you could say that's a good collector because they collect all these wonderful things and we get to see them in palaces with their names written on the side. This is sort of celebrating the slightly mad, the hoarder rather than the collector. So we've got Nabokov's butterflies that he collected when he was an older man, and he was as if he was trying to chase and pin that youth to a corkboard. And so we've got his collection of butterflies. We've got all sorts of wonderful things there. What makes a good collector, Steve? Someone that does it for love, I think, rather than money. We were all enthralled, actually, by a recent story, weren't we, in the New Yorker about the Freeport in Geneva, which is full of billionaires' art collections, air-conditioned within an inch of its life that no one can see. I think this show at the New Museum celebrates the crazier, more hoardery, attic-dwelling collector than the super collector.
Me and Robert have met people who are doing the auction of David Bowie's collection.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, one of the most... I wasn't quite sure what I felt, because it's about to be split up and sold and there's hundreds of works. But what you saw in what he bought was, he bought with passion, he built up a narrative between all the pieces, he wasn't always buying expensive, he bought some, you know, he bought Auerbach, but he bought smaller British artists who had almost been forgotten. I think that's a collector who starts from a small dot and builds up this whole world around them.
Yeah, and he wasn't... Bowie's collection as well, like any good collection, like this thing at the New Museum as well, isn't about having good taste, it's about liking things. And that's a really, really, really important, presumably, starting point and end point for any collection.
And do you worry that when collecting is often discussed in the media, it's all about the price tag and, you know, and the fame, perhaps, of the work, rather than, as you're saying, for the love of collecting?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is even the art press has got this bad habit from the mainstream press that people are interested in lots of zeros next to each other rather than someone telling a story and someone being very passionate about something. It's very easy to put that in a headline, but passion and interest and intrigue and strangeness is less easy to accommodate in a 30-word cell on a newspaper front page or page 16 or wherever art sits these days. Now it's not the 90s.
And if you want to know more about collecting, you should, of course, be reading Monocle magazine, because you have, Rob, now your very own collecting
page. There's a collecting
page.
Section, there's all sorts of stuff, and it is well served also at Monocle 24, I think. There's plenty of art stuff.
There we are. Robert Bound, Matt Alagaya, Andrew Tuck, thank you all very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, by Barclay Bram and by Jakob Ladener. The studio manager was Christopher Grimes.
Thank you, Chris.
There's a round of applause because it's his last day. More music will be next. Then at 1900, it's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. The Michael Daly, 2200. Do stay tuned for that. Midori House back on Monday, 1800 London, 1300 New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Have a wonderful weekend wherever you are in the world. Goodbye.